We continue now with the current installment of how Reb Baruch, the father of the Alter Rebbe, became a chassid of the Baal Shem Tov. We're in the midst of telling about the discoveries Reb Baruch made about chassidus, and that most of them came from Rabbi Yitzchak Scholl. And Reb Baruch was noticing the great difference between Rabbi Yitzchak Scholl, who was a chassid, and his two brothers-in-law, Yitzchak Scholl's two brothers-in-law, who were not. Another discovery that Baruch made about chassidus and chassidim was that it taught one how to be in control of oneself. As he observed the heated discussions which took place between Yitzchak Scholl and his brothers-in-law, who never seemed to see eye to eye, he saw how frequently the elder young men gave free vent to their feelings. But whereas Yitzchak Scholl showed himself as quick as they to get into a temper, no sooner was his anger kindled than he suddenly seemed to close up, as if with a lock and key, and his anger totally disappeared. He explained this to his friend Baruch one day, saying, "My father used to say to me in the name of the Baal Shem that anger is a foreign and unworthy thing, even when it springs from Yiras Shamayim, from the fear of heaven. He taught me that whenever I get into a temper, I should seal my lips and not utter a word." Baruch was very impressed. He decided he would like to know more about Yitzchak Scholl's brothers-in-law, to get at their background and education, to see what had brought them to their particular viewpoint. What sort of person, for instance, was Moshe Leib? Baruch went into the matter very thoroughly and discovered quite an interesting story. It appeared that Moshe Leib was born in Lupalov, a suburb of Mo'oliv on the river Dnieper. He came of a very distinguished family. He was the 10th generation of a distinguished Spanish-Jewish family, natives of Castile in Spain. During the Inquisition, they fled the country, seeking refuge in Tuscany. From there, the family had to wander anew, and as they wearily made their way from town to town, they eventually arrived in Mohilev and settled there. Moshe Leib's ancestor of 10 generations back was Rabbi Yitzchak, who was a pupil of the well-known Goyim of that period. It was also said about him that he was the pupil of the great saint and Goyim, Rabbi Shem Tov. Following the family tradition, Rabbi Yitzchak became a great scholar. His father was a very wealthy businessman. The son assisted him in his business dealings, but above all else, he devoted himself to Torah study. Rabbi Yitzchak reached Mo'oliv at an advanced age. He was accompanied by his son, Nosson Nota, and grandson, Nachman. They immediately began to do business with the local duke, and their business increased and spread in all the surrounding towns and townlets. Soon after, Nochem's wife died childless. He then married again, this time choosing as his wife the daughter of a well-respected man in Minsk. As his second wife also was childless, his grandfather advised him to take an oath that should he be blessed with a son, he would give him up entirely to the study of Torah. Nachman followed the advice of his grandfather, and after a few years, his wife presented him with a son, whom they called Chaim Yeshua. Nachman kept his oath, and his son devoted himself completely to the study of the Torah and Avodas Hashem, the service of God. When he eventually married and had a son named Moshe, the latter not merely followed in his father's footsteps, but lived as a Nazarite. Moshe was married but a year when his wife gave birth to a son to carry on the family name and tradition. Moshe's grandson, Nosson Nota, was Moshe Leib's grandfather, was the preacher of Lupalov, and became known as an ardent preacher and moralist. He took up his role following a dream he had, in which his grandfather, Moshe, appeared before him and told him that his mission in life was to become a maggid. Yosef Akiva, the son of the preacher, already at the age of 13, knew the entire Talmud and was known as the Goyen, the genius of Lupalov. At the age of 18, he married into a well-known family of Mohilev. Yosef Akiva lived at the house of his father-in-law for 20 years, and he studied assiduously, while his father-in-law supported him. The one thing which marred his happiness was the fact that he had no children. When his wife died, her father persuaded him to marry the younger daughter, but though they lived together for 6 years, until she died, he still had no children. Now that he was widowed for the second time, Yosef Akiva had no heart to stay in Mohilev any longer. It was therefore a timely coincidence that just at this time there arrived in the city a certain messenger from Smilovich who told him that he had come specially to see him. He told him that there had been opened in Smilovich a yeshiva which was somewhat remarkable and that it was limited to accepting but 10 picked scholars, and he, the messenger, had come specially to invite him to come to this yeshiva to be one of the chosen quorum. This messenger was no less a person than Gaon Rav Menachem Shloime, and he had come at the express wish of the rich Leibele, whose son-in-law conducted the yeshiva with his Leibele's money. Yosef Akiva's fame having reached as far as Smilovich, they decided to invite him to join their yeshiva as one of the brilliant group of men who studied there. This Leibele originated from Prague, but had already lived in Smilovich for several decades. When he first came to Smilovich, he immediately had built a Beis HaMedrash and supported 10 Talmidei Chachamim so that they could sit and study there without any financial worries. Leibele had several sons and daughters. When his eldest daughter became of marriageable age, he sent one of these scholars to Vilna to choose a worthy young man to be her husband. He chose Moshe Leib, who was known as the Ili of Taraki, as he came from this townlet, which was near Vilna. After Moshe Leib had been living for 20 years at the home of his father-in-law, and had been supported by him, it occurred to the latter that having such a learned son-in-law, he might as well establish a yeshiva there under Moshe Leib's direction. He decided that this yeshiva should only accept 10 picked scholars who would reap a greater benefit by being limited in number. Leibele then chose as a special messenger the Gaon Rav Menachem Shloime, whom he had sent to all Jewish towns and townlets to find suitable candidates for his son-in-law's yeshiva. He said they must be the best scholars that could be found, and he knew full well that no one was a more competent judge in the matter than Rav Menachem Shloime. Rabbi Yosef Akiva, who was by nature a recluse, had no great urge to go to Smilovich, nor had he much faith in the scholarship of Leibele's son-in-law, judging by what he had heard of him. But because he was still heartbroken at his wife's death, and further troubled by the fact of being left childless, he decided that he might as well leave Mohilev and go to Smilovich. The manner of testing the prospective candidate to see if his scholarship was of sufficiently high standard to become one of the selected students was as follows. Each candidate had to prepare a pilpul to be delivered over a period of 3 days. Notice would be given beforehand of the sugya to be discussed, the subject matter, and the theme, so that those who had come to listen could study the subject and the better be able to judge the extent of the candidate's knowledge and scholarship. The pilpul had to be delivered in the Beis HaMedrash before an assembly of all the learned men of the city, after which the Rosh Yeshiva Rav Moshe Leib analyzed the pilpul critically, showing any weak spots in the presentation, and then reconstructing it as it should be presented. After all the 10 candidates had presented their pilpulim, and the Rosh Yeshiva had dealt with them, as just mentioned, Yosef Akiva could not help admitting that Moshe Leib was indeed a great scholar. He was glad to have passed the test. Yosef Akiva studied at this yeshiva for 3 years, where the order of the day was as follows. Every one of the 10 scholars began his studies at midnight, continuing right up to the morning, except for a break of an hour in the morning for shachris, for the morning service. After mincha, they ate a light lunch and retired for an hour's sleep. They continued their studies until after Maariv, when they ate their second meal, and then went to bed for 4 hours, waking in time to resume their studies at midnight. No conversation was permitted which did not relate to either Torah study or to divine service, and the atmosphere was naturally a very sacred one. Yet, despite being removed from the toil and moil and cares of everyday life, Yosef Akiva, who was so steeped in his studies which he loved dearly, could not, nevertheless, he could find no peace for his aching heart, and decided after all to leave Smilevich. Though firm in his decision to leave Smilevich, Yosef Akiva was not clear in his mind where he should go. He just felt he must leave the town. One night he had a dream in which his father appeared to him and reproved him for not having sufficient faith. He told him to travel to a place called Krushte, where he would find his peace of mind. But before leaving Smilevich, he was to fast to atone for his sin of lack of faith. It was Sfira time when he began his fasts. He undertook 40 fast days in addition to the regular fasts of Monday and Thursday. Thus, it was not until the end of the month of Tammuz that he was through with his self-imposed atonement. Yosef Akiva left Smilevich in the middle of the month of Av and wandered from town to town and through townlets and villages until finally he was in sight of his destination, the townlet of Krushne. It was a few days before Slichus when he stopped to spend the night at the house of a villager in the vicinity of Krushne. While there, he heard that in the nearby town, a public fast had been arranged for the following day, and the Rav of the town was going to preach in the afternoon. Yosef Akiva, together with his host, went into town the next day, and came to the Beis HaMedrash in time to hear the Rav's drasha, which explained the importance of Slichus, followed by Mincha and Ma'ariv. To Yosef Akiva's great astonishment, he saw the Rav coming towards him with outstretched hand, greeting him like an old friend, and then all the Gaboyim followed suit. His wonder increased when he saw the Shamash bringing out the register of the congregants' names, and then arranged to draw lots. It soon became clear to him that he was the cause of the activity. It was then explained to him that whenever a visitor came to town, everybody wanted to have the privilege of being his host. Therefore, in order to avoid any ill feeling, they decided that the fairest solution of the problem was to cast lots to decide who should be the host, where the visitor should have his meals, and in whose house he should sleep. As everybody in the town was so anxious to enjoy the honor of having a guest, it was the custom that when a member had already had the pleasure of acting as a host to a guest, his name was not included in the casting of lots when the next visitor came along. In this way, it was felt that everyone would eventually get his turn. On this particular occasion, the lot was drawn by Shlomo the Bookseller. He was absolutely overjoyed at his good fortune. His face shone with a radiance as if he had found some precious stone. And everybody, including the Rav, came up to him and greeted him with a hearty mazel tov, as if the occasion were truly a festive one. All this made a tremendous impression upon Yosef Akiva, as it was, to say the least of it, most unusual. Generally, he observed in other towns that whenever a visitor came along, unless, of course, he was some distinguished personality, one would wait for the next person to invite the guest. Yosef Akiva, however, quickly told these hospitable people that while he was exceedingly kind of them to make him so welcome, he did not require anything of anyone, as it was contrary to his principles to put anyone to the slightest trouble on his account. The butcher's face fell with disappointment. The Rav, too, looked very disappointed as he came forward and explained to Yosef Akiva that this was not a matter of troubling anyone, but a case of giving somebody the opportunity to perform the mitzvah of achnasas erchem, of hospitality. And whereas it was the duty of every Jew to seek and carry out this mitzvah, it was at the same time the duty of a guest to cooperate. It was a sort of a joint mitzvah, as it required both host and guest to make it a reality. When the matter was put to him in this light, Yosef Akiva had no choice but to accept the hospitality so warmly and sincerely offered him. And so he accompanied the butcher to his home, much to the latter's delight. When they arrived at the house, the guest was received with great respect. The table was prepared as if for royalty, set with all sorts of delicacies that might please the palate of the honored guest. Their disappointment was all the greater in consequence when Rabbi Yosef told them that he was sorry that he had gone to so much trouble, as he never ate meat during the weekdays, and in any case he was accustomed to eating very little. The entire Jewish community of Kedushta was composed of but 35 families. The majority earned their livelihood from the produce of their fields and the greens and vegetables of their gardens. There were also wool combers, weavers, tailors, and cobblers. All had some education, and a number of them were scholars. All without exception were God-fearing Jews. They availed themselves of every opportunity of davening with the congregation, with the minyan. And even during harvesting, they arranged to meet to daven in a special corner of the field, which was fenced around according to the din, where they met for davening in the mornings and in the afternoons. Yosef Akiva stayed at the home of Shlomo for 4 days, which also included Shabbos. Meantime, it became known in Kedushta that they were entertaining no ordinary person, but had a most distinguished guest in their midst. This matter of hospitality to visitors was no individual responsibility in Kedushta. It was the care of the whole community, so that even in the case where the winning name was drawn by a poor man, he was given all expenses covering the costs of entertaining the guest in his home. It was therefore decided now to do all that was possible to persuade Yosef Akiva to remain permanently in Kedushta. The Jewish community planned to find proper and comfortable accommodations for the worthy visitor. This was found at the home of the Chazan Eliyahu Shmuel, who was given sufficient money to assure that Yosef Akiva should have everything necessary to make him comfortable. During the 10 days of repentance, the Rav invited Yosef Akiva to conduct a shir, and all the congregation was invited to attend. They were all so favorably impressed with the vast scholarship of their guest that they asked him to establish a yeshiva in the town. The Rav, hearing that Yosef Akiva was a widower, suggested to him that he marry his sister, who was a widow. Yosef Akiva agreed, and the wedding was arranged without delay. 4 years later, they were blessed with a son, whom they named Meshulab, after the Iloy of Taraki, in whose yeshiva in Smilovich Yosef Akiva had studied. This Meshulab was the same who later became the son-in-law of Eliezer Reuven, the smith of the Brumsel. 5 years later, Yosef Akiva became the head of the yeshiva in Beshenkovich. He was by nature a very quiet man, a lover of solitude. When he finished his lectures, he invariably betook himself to a corner of the Beis HaMedrash, where he learned Torah quietly. He never joined the others at the table in their discussions, nor did he ever join them in their various celebrations. No one had ever seen him with a smile on his serious face, and certainly he had never been heard to laugh. When his son Meshulab became Bar Mitzvah, Yosef Akiva made no fuss about it. He arranged no party. Meshulab delivered his speech as pilpul in the yeshiva. His mother had brought wine and cakes for those presents, but his father did not partake of any of it. He asked the shamish to do the honors and see that the guests should have a drink and a bite. The shamish was one named Wolf, and a very remarkable person he was as well. He had a son who was called Grunem Eli, and he and Meshulab were the best of friends. It was from Grunem Eli that Meshulab learned that very often when important people traveled through Beshenkovich, they were entertained by his father Wolf, who seemed on excellent terms with these important visitors. He further told him that a number of them were mystics and Kabbalists, and it had been said of them that they had seen Eliyahu HaNavi. They merited to see Elisha the prophet. Grunem Eli told his friend that he himself had the honor of meeting and becoming acquainted with some of these men, and Meshulab, hearing this, felt very intrigued and greatly interested. In Meshenkovich, where Meshulab had been brought up and educated at the local yeshiva, where his father was the head, there lived a Jew named Nehemiah, who was a tanner. He worked at the tannery of Shmuel Tzvi. Now, this Nehemiah used to make a practice of attending the Beis HaMedrash at midnight, when he would settle down to learning and saying Tilim until it was time for Shachris. After this, he would set off for his work to return again for Mincha and Ma'arif. Once, while Meshulab was studying the Beis HaMedrash with his friend Grunem Eli, both studying together, the father of Grunem Eli, namely Wolf the Shamish, came up to listen to them. From time to time he put in a question or put forward some suggestion or explanation of some difficult passage, which disclosed that he was a scholar of no mean measure. Meanwhile, there entered Yishayahu, the storekeeper, and he too lent an ear to the way the boys were studying together. He was obviously very favorably impressed, for he turned to the Shamash, saying, "These two boys will, with God's help, become great scholars. You must be very proud indeed of your brilliant son, eh?" he asked, expecting an appreciative reply to his complimentary remark. Instead, he was surprised to hear the Shamash calmly say, "Our sages tell us that good deeds are greater in importance than knowledge. I would therefore much rather have my son become a God-fearing Jew, say, like Nehemiah the Tanner, than have him become a great scholar whose sole concern is that he be given the honor he considers his merit for his learning." This reply simply infuriated Yishayahu, who for some reason felt the remark was an implied criticism directed against himself. And so he burst out hotly, "I might have guessed, Rolf, that you belong to the Kat." This was the early name which the Misnagdim called the Hasidim, the sect. "And as you associate so largely with the ignorant Jews, you probably regard them with higher esteem than you would scholars. I have long known that you have connection with the so-called mystics. And what are they after all but lazy idlers?" The two boys stopped their studies to see what would happen now. But there seemed to be a real quarrel pending between the two men. But as Mishaleb later related to Baruch, the Shamash refused to be drawn into a quarrel. He remained as calm as ever, and he quietly said, "Our sages advise us never to attempt to convince anyone of anything while the person is in a temper, even when he is justifiably enraged. How much truer is this advice in the case where the angry person is in the wrong? For he certainly is in no mood to listen to reason. When you become calmer, my friend, we will continue our talk. For the present, it is wiser that we keep silent." Wolf's words seemed to have a quieting effect upon Yishayahu, and he became calmer, admitting that he was wrong to have flared up as he did. "But in truth," he continued, "I must say that I fail to see how you can spend so much time with these so-called mystics whose sole concern seems to be to associate with ignorant men and women. You know as well as I do that our sages warn us not to marry into families that are ignorant, nor to sit at the same table with ignorant people, and that the word of such people cannot be trusted. In short, to keep as far as possible from uneducated people. To strengthen this warning, we are further told that we must pay the highest respect to scholars, that it is our duty to provide them with their needs, so that in so doing we are, so to say, paying homage to God. Now here are these men I am talking about, who not only act in contradiction to what our sages have recommended, but even disguise their misguided deeds under a cloak of piety. That is indeed very wrong," Yishayahu concluded emphatically. "According to your point of view, you're absolutely right, except that your point of view itself is wrong," replied the Shamash. "For you should know that these mystics are not only saintly men, but are in addition very great scholars. There are some among them who know the entire Shas by heart and are very learned in many branches of our holy teachings. And above all, they are all pious, God-fearing Jews. They fast frequently and live very frugal lives, sacrificing their bodily comforts in their communal wanderings through town and villages, happy in the thought that they are helping their fellow Jews in the remotest places to come back to an understanding and appreciation of the Creator. The fact that they represent themselves as ordinary people and dress like ordinary folk is just so that these ordinary folk may feel more comfortable in their company, and thus the mystics can more easily learn of the problems and difficulties of the people and help them so much more. They speak to them in a language they can readily grasp, and thus help them to reach a higher spiritual level. And don't imagine," Wolf continued, "that each of these mystics is merely following his own particular plan. I can tell you positively that every one of them has had his mission assigned to him and has been told in which area is his sphere of influence. Taken as a whole, they all form part of a large, comprehensive whole with its inspiration emanating from their head. This particular society of people," continued Wolf in a way that showed he knew all of what he was talking about, And even as if he were also one of them, this society is quite an old one. It was first established by the Tzaddik, the Gaon Rabbi Yoav Baal Shem of Worms, Germany. Thus, the movement is about 110 years old. Rabbi Yoav Baal Shem established this society upon the request of a certain Kabbalist whose identity is unknown to this day. We are told that this Kabbalist requested that chosen Goyim and Tzaddikim would should be prepared to dedicate their whole lives to this sacred work. And they should be sent out amongst the poor, simple, uneducated, and unawakened Jews to make them aware of their Creator and of the spiritual values in life. Mirza Hashem, in the next installment, we will continue with the words of Wolf de Shamish as he describes the founding of the Hasidic movement as it was by Rabbi Yoav Baal Shem Tov, as this was related by Rabbi Moshe Leib to Rabbi Baruch.